This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Road to Character by David Brooks. Read for you by Arthur Morey. With an introduction read by the author.
Introduction. Adam 2. Recently, I've been thinking about the difference between the resume virtues and the eulogy virtues. The resume virtues are the ones you list on your resume, the skills that you bring to the job market, and that contribute to external success. The eulogy virtues are deeper. They're the virtues that get talked about at your funeral, the ones that exist at the core of your being, whether you are kind, brave, honest, or faithful, what kind of relationships you formed. Most of us would say that the eulogy virtues are more important than the resume virtues. But I confess that for long stretches of my life, I've spent more time thinking about the latter than the former. Our education system is certainly oriented around the resume virtues more than the eulogy ones. Public conversation is, too. The self-help tips in magazines, the nonfiction bestsellers. Most of us have clearer strategies for how to achieve career success than we do for how to develop a profound character. One book that has helped me think about these two sets of virtues is Lonely Man of Faith, which was written by Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik in 1965. Soloveitchik noted that there are two accounts of creation in Genesis, and argued that these represent the two opposing sides of our nature, which he called Adam 1 and Adam 2. Modernizing Soloveitchik's categories a bit, we could say that Adam 1 is the career-oriented, ambitious side of our nature. Adam 1 is the external resume Adam. Adam 1 wants to build, create, produce, and discover things. He wants to have high status and win victories. Adam 2 is the internal Adam. Adam 2 wants to embody certain moral qualities. Adam 2 wants to have a serene inner character, a quiet but solid sense of right and wrong, not only to do good, but to be good. Adam 2 wants to love intimately, to sacrifice self in the service of others, to live in obedience to some transcendent truth, to have a cohesive inner soul that honors creation and one's own possibilities. While Adam 1 wants to conquer the world, Adam 2 wants to obey a calling to serve the world. While Adam 1 is creative and savors his own accomplishments, Adam 2 sometimes renounces worldly success and status for the sake of some sacred purpose. While Adam 1 asks how things work, Adam 2 asks why things exist and what ultimately we are here for. While Adam 1 wants to venture forth, Adam 2 wants to return to his roots and savor the warmth of a family meal. While Adam 1's motto is success, Adam 2 experiences life as a moral drama. His motto is charity, love, and redemption. Soloveitchik argued that we live in the contradiction between these two Adams. The outer majestic Adam and the inner humble Adam are not fully reconcilable. We are forever caught in self-confrontation. We are called to fulfill both personae, and must master the art of living forever within the tension between these two natures. The hard part of this confrontation, I'd add, is that Adams 1 and 2 live by different logics. Adam 1, the creating, building, and discovering Adam, lives by a straightforward utilitarian logic. It's the logic of economics. Input leads to output. Effort leads to reward. Practice makes perfect. Pursue self-interest. Maximize your utility. Impress the world. Adam 2 lives by an inverse logic. It's a moral logic, not an economic one. You have to give to receive. You have to surrender to something outside yourself to gain strength within yourself. You have to conquer your desire to get what you crave. Success leads to the greatest failure, which is pride. Failure leads to the greatest success, which is humility and learning. In order to fulfill yourself, you have to forget yourself. In order to find yourself, you have to lose yourself. To nurture your Adam 1 career, it makes sense to cultivate your strengths. To nurture your Adam 2 moral core, it is necessary to confront your weaknesses. The shrewd animal. We live in a culture that nurtures Adam 1, the external Adam, and neglects Adam 2. We live in a society that encourages us to think about how to have a great career, but leaves many of us inarticulate about how to cultivate the inner life. The competition to succeed and win admiration is so fierce that it becomes all-consuming. The consumer marketplace encourages us to live by a utilitarian calculus, to satisfy our desires and lose sight of the moral stakes involved in everyday decisions. The noise of fast and shallow communications makes it harder to hear the quieter sounds that emanate from the depths. We live in a culture that teaches us to promote and advertise ourselves, and to master the skills required for success. But that gives little encouragement to humility, sympathy, and honest self-confrontation, which are necessary for building character. If you are only Adam One, you turn into a shrewd animal, a crafty, self-preserving creature who is adept at playing the game and who turns everything into a game. If that's all you have, you spend a lot of time cultivating professional skills, but you don't have a clear idea of the sources of meaning in life. So you don't know where you should devote your skills, which career path will be highest and best. Years pass and the deepest parts of yourself go unexplored and unstructured. You are busy, but you have a vague anxiety that your life has not achieved its ultimate meaning and significance. You live with an unconscious boredom, not really loving, not really attached to the moral purposes that give life its worth. You lack the internal criteria to make unshakable commitments. You never develop inner constancy, the integrity that can withstand popular disapproval or a serious blow. You find yourself doing things that other people approve of, whether these things are right for you or not. You foolishly judge other people by their abilities, not by their worth. You do not have a strategy to build character, and without that, not only your inner life, but also your external life will eventually fall to pieces. This book is about Adam too. It's about how some people have cultivated strong character. It's about one mindset that people through the centuries have adopted to put iron in their core and to cultivate a wise heart. I wrote it to save my soul. I was born with a natural disposition toward shallowness. I now work as a pundit and columnist. I'm paid to be a narcissistic blowhard, to volley my opinions, to appear more confident about them than I really am, to appear smarter than I really am, to appear better and more authoritative than I really am. I have to work harder than most people to avoid a life of smug superficiality. I've also become more aware that, like many people these days, I've lived a life of vague moral aspiration. Vaguely wanting to be good, vaguely wanting to serve some larger purpose, while lacking a concrete moral vocabulary, a clear understanding of how to live a rich inner life, or even a clear knowledge of how character is developed and depth is achieved. I've discovered that without a rigorous focus on the Adam II side of our nature, it is easy to slip into a self-satisfied moral mediocrity. You grade yourself on a forgiving curve. You follow your desires wherever they take you, and you approve of yourself so long as you're not obviously hurting anyone else. You figure that if people around you seem to like you, you must be good enough. In the process, you end up slowly turning yourself into something a little less impressive than you had originally hoped. A humiliating gap opens up between your actual self and your desired self. You realize that the voice of your Adam One is loud, but the voice of your Adam Two is muffled. The life plan of Adam One is clear, but the life plan of Adam Two is fuzzy. Adam One is alert, Adam Two is sleepwalking. I wrote this book not sure I could follow the road to character, but I wanted at least to know what the road looks like and how other people have trodden it. The plan. The plan of this book is simple. In the next chapter, I will describe an older moral ecology. It was a cultural and intellectual tradition, the crooked timber tradition, that emphasized our own brokenness. It was a tradition that demanded humility in the face of our own limitations. But it was also a tradition that held that each of us has the power to confront our own weaknesses, tackle our own sins, and that in the course of this confrontation with ourselves, we build character. By successfully confronting sin and weakness, we have a chance to play our own role in a great moral drama. We can shoot for something higher than happiness. We have a chance to take advantage of everyday occasions to build virtue in ourselves and be of service to the world. Then I will describe what this character-building method looks like in real life by means of biographical essays, which are also moral essays. Since Plutarch, moralists have tried to communicate certain standards by holding up exemplars. You can't build rich Adam II lives simply by reading sermons or following abstract rules. Example is the best teacher. Moral improvement occurs most reliably when the heart is warmed, when we come into contact with people we admire and love, and we consciously and unconsciously bend our lives to mimic theirs. This truth was hammered home to me after I wrote a column expressing frustration with how hard it is to learn from classroom experience how to be good. A veterinarian named Dave Jolly sent me an email that cut to the chase. The heart cannot be taught in a classroom intellectually, to students mechanically taking notes. Good, wise hearts are obtained through lifetimes of diligent effort to dig deeply within and heal lifetimes of scars. You can't teach it or email it or tweet it. It has to be discovered within the depths of one's own heart when a person is finally ready to go looking for it and not before. The job of the wise person is to swallow the frustration and just go on setting an example of caring and digging and diligence in their own lives. What a wise person teaches is the smallest part of what they give. The totality of their life, of the way they go about it in the smallest details, is what gets transmitted. Never forget that. The message is the person. Perfected over lifetimes of effort that was set in motion by yet another wise person, now hidden from the recipient by the dim mists of time. Life is much bigger than we think. Cause and effect intertwined in a vast moral structure that keeps pushing us to do better, become better, even when we dwell in the most painful, confused darkness. Those words explain the methodology of this book. The subjects of the portraits that follow in chapters 2 through 10 are a diverse set. White and black, male and female, religious and secular, literary and non-literary. None of them is even close to perfect. But they practiced a mode of living that is less common now. They were acutely aware of their own weaknesses. They waged an internal struggle against their sins and emerged with some measure of self-respect. And when we think of them, it's not primarily what they accomplished that we remember, great though that may have been. It's who they were. I'm hoping their examples will fire this fearful longing we all have to be better and to follow their course. In the final chapter, I wrap these themes up. I describe how our culture has made it harder to be good, and I summarize this crooked timber approach to life in a series of specific points. If you're impatient for the condensed message of this book, skip to the end. Occasionally, even today, you come across people who possess an impressive inner cohesion. They are not leading fragmented, scattershot lives. They have achieved inner integration. They are calm, settled, and rooted. They are not blown off course by storms. They don't crumble in adversity. Their minds are consistent, and their hearts are dependable. Their virtues are not the blooming virtues you see in smart college students. They are the ripening virtues you see in people who have lived a little and have learned from joy and pain. Sometimes you don't even notice these people because while they seem kind and cheerful, they're also reserved. They possess the self-effacing virtues of people who are inclined to be useful, but don't need to prove anything to the world. Humility, restraint, reticence, temperance, respect, and gentle self-discipline. They radiate a sort of moral joy. They answer softly when challenged harshly. They are silent when unfairly abused. They are dignified when others try to humiliate them, restrained when others try to provoke them. But they get things done. They perform acts of sacrificial service with the same modest spirit they would display if they were just getting the groceries. They are not thinking about what impressive work they are doing. They are not thinking about themselves at all. They just seem delighted by the flawed people around them. They just recognize what needs doing, and they do it. They make you feel funnier and smarter when you speak with them. They move through different social classes, not even aware, it seems, that they are doing so. After you've known them for a while, it occurs to you that you've never heard them boast. You've never seen them self-righteous or doggedly certain. They aren't dropping little hints of their own distinctiveness and accomplishments. They have not led lives of conflict-free tranquility, but they have struggled toward maturity. They have gone some way toward solving life's essential problem, which is that, as Alexander Solzhenitsyn put it, the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart. These are the people who have built a strong inner character, who have achieved a certain depth. In these people, the climb to success has surrendered to the struggle to deepen the soul. After a life of seeking balance, Adam 1 has bowed down before Adam 2. These are the people we are looking for.
Chapter 1. The Shift. On Sunday evenings, my local NPR station rebroadcasts old radio programs. A few years ago, I was driving home and heard a program called Command Performance, which was a variety show that went out to the troops during World War II. The episode I happened to hear was broadcast the day after VJ Day, on August 15, 1945. The episode featured some of the era's biggest celebrities: Frank Sinatra, Marlene Dietrich, Cary Grant, Betty Davis, and many others. But the most striking feature of the show was its tone of self-effacement and humility. The Allies had just completed one of the noblest military victories in human history. And yet there was no chest beating. Nobody was erecting triumphal arches. "Well, it looks like this is it," the host, Bing Crosby, opened. "What can you say at a time like this? You can't throw your skimmer in the air. That's for run-of-the-mill holidays. I guess all anybody can do is thank God it's over." The mezzo-soprano Risa Stevens came on and sang a solemn version of Ave Maria, and then Crosby came back on to summarize the mood. "Today, though, our deep-down feeling is one of humility." That sentiment was repeated throughout the broadcast. The actor Burgess Meredith read a passage written by Ernie Pyle, the war correspondent. Pyle had been killed just a few months before, but he had written an article anticipating what victory would mean. "We won this war because our men are brave and because of many other things, because of Russia, England, and China, and the passage of time, and the gift of nature's materials. We did not win it because destiny created us better than all other people. I hope that in victory, we are more grateful than proud." The show mirrored the reaction of the nation at large. There were rapturous celebrations, certainly. Sailors in San Francisco commandeered cable cars and looted liquor stores. The streets of New York's Garment District were 5 inches deep in confetti. But the mood was divided. Joy gave way to solemnity and self-doubt. This was in part because the war had been such an epical event and had produced such rivers of blood that individuals felt small in comparison. There was also the manner in which the war in the Pacific had ended, with the atomic bomb. People around the world had just seen the savagery human beings are capable of. Now here was a weapon that could make that savagery apocalyptic. The knowledge of victory was as charged with sorrow and doubt as with joy and gratitude, James Agee wrote in an editorial that week for Time magazine. But the modest tone of Command Performance wasn't just a matter of mood or style. The people on that broadcast had been part of one of the most historic victories ever known. But they didn't go around telling themselves how great they were. They didn't print up bumper stickers commemorating their own awesomeness. Their first instinct was to remind themselves they were not morally superior to anyone else. Their collective impulse was to warn themselves against pride and self-glorification. They intuitively resisted the natural human tendency toward excessive self-love. I arrived home before the program was over and listened to that radio show in my driveway for a time. Then I went inside and turned on a football game. A quarterback threw a short pass to a wide receiver who was tackled almost immediately for a 2-yard gain. The defensive player did what all professional athletes do these days in moments of personal accomplishment. He did a self-puffing victory dance as the camera lingered. It occurred to me that I had just watched more self-celebration after a 2-yard gain than I had heard after the United States won World War II. This little contrast set off a chain of thoughts in my mind. It occurred to me that this shift might symbolize a shift in culture, a shift from a culture of self-effacement that says, nobody's better than me, but I'm no better than anyone else, to a culture of self-promotion that says, recognize my accomplishments, I'm pretty special. That contrast, while nothing much in itself, was like a doorway into the different ways it is possible to live in this world. Little Me. In the years following that command performance episode, I went back and studied that time and the people who were prominent then. The research reminded me, first of all, that none of us should ever wish to go back to the culture of the mid-20th century. It was a more racist, sexist, and anti-Semitic culture. Most of us would not have had the opportunities we enjoy if we had lived back then. It was also a more boring culture, with bland food and homogeneous living arrangements. It was an emotionally cold culture. Fathers, in particular, frequently were unable to express their love for their own children. Husbands were unable to see the depth in their own wives. In so many ways, life is better now than it was then. But it did occur to me that there was perhaps a strain of humility that was more common then than now. That there was a moral ecology, stretching back centuries but less prominent now, encouraging people to be more skeptical of their desires, more aware of their own weaknesses, more intent on combating the flaws in their own natures, and turning weakness into strength. People in this tradition, I thought, are less likely to feel that every thought, feeling, and achievement should be immediately shared with the world at large. The popular culture seemed more reticent in the era of command performance. There were no message t-shirts back then, no exclamation points on the typewriter keyboards, no sympathy ribbons for various diseases, no vanity license plates, no bumper stickers with personal or moral declarations. People didn't brag about their college affiliations or their vacation spots with little stickers on the rear windows of their cars. There was stronger social sanction against, as they would have put it, blowing your own trumpet, getting above yourself, being too big for your britches. The social code was embodied in the self-effacing style of actors like Gregory Peck or Gary Cooper, or the character Joe Friday on Dragnet. When Franklin Roosevelt's aide Harry Hopkins lost a son in World War II, the military brass wanted to put his other sons out of harm's way. Hopkins rejected this idea, writing, with the understatement more common in that era, that his other sons shouldn't be given safe assignments just because their brother had some bad luck in the Pacific. Of the 23 men and women who served in Dwight Eisenhower's cabinets, only one, the Secretary of Agriculture, published a memoir afterward, and it was so discreet as to be soporific. By the time the Reagan administration rolled around, 12 of his 30 cabinet members published memoirs, almost all of them self-advertising. When the elder George Bush, who was raised in that era, was running for president, he, having inculcated the values of his childhood, resisted speaking about himself. If a speechwriter put the word "I" in one of his speeches, he'd instinctively cross it out. The staff would beg him, "You're running for president. You've got to talk about yourself." Eventually, they'd cow him into doing so. But the next day, he'd get a call from his mother. "George, you're talking about yourself again," she'd say, and Bush would revert to form. No more eyes in the speeches, no more self-promotion. The Big Me. Over the next few years, I collected data to suggest that we have seen a broad shift from a culture of humility to the culture of what you might call the Big Me. From a culture that encouraged people to think humbly of themselves to a culture that encouraged people to see themselves as the center of the universe. It wasn't hard to find such data. For example, in 1950, the Gallup organization asked high school seniors if they considered themselves to be a very important person. At that point, 12% said yes. The same question was asked in 2005, and this time it wasn't 12% who considered themselves very important, it was 80%. Psychologists have a thing called the narcissism test. They read people's statements and ask if the statements apply to them. Statements such as, "I like to be the center of attention," "I show off if I get the chance because I am extraordinary," "Somebody should write a biography about me." The median narcissism score has risen 30% in the last two decades. 93% of young people score higher than the middle score just 20 years ago. The largest gains have been in the number of people who agree with the statements, "I am an extraordinary person, and I like to look at my body." Along with this apparent rise in self-esteem, there has been a tremendous increase in the desire for fame. Fame used to rank low as a life's ambition for most people. In a 1976 survey that asked people to list their life goals, fame ranked 15th out of 16. By 2007, 51% of young people reported that being famous was one of their top personal goals. In one study, middle school girls were asked who they would most like to have dinner with. Jennifer Lopez came in first. Jesus Christ came in second, and Paris Hilton third. The girls were then asked which of the following jobs they would like to have. Nearly twice as many said they'd rather be a celebrity's personal assistant, for example Justin Bieber's, than president of Harvard. Though, to be fair, I'm pretty sure the president of Harvard would also rather be Justin Bieber's personal assistant. As I looked around the popular culture, I kept finding the same messages everywhere. You are special. Trust yourself. Be true to yourself. Movies from Pixar and Disney are constantly telling children how wonderful they are. Commencement speeches are larded with the same cliches. Follow your passion. Don't accept limits. Chart your own course. You have a responsibility to do great things because you are so great. This is the gospel of self-trust. As Ellen DeGeneres put it in a 2009 commencement address, "My advice to you is to be true to yourself and everything will be fine." Celebrity chef Mario Batali advised graduates to follow your own truth expressed consistently by you. Anna Quindlen urged another audience to have the courage to honor your character, your intellect, your inclinations, and yes, your soul by listening to its clean, clear voice instead of following the muddied messages of a timid world. In her mega best-selling book, Eat, Pray, Love, I am the only man ever to finish this book, Elizabeth Gilbert wrote that God manifests himself through my own voice from within my own self. God dwells within you as you yourself, exactly the way you are. I began looking at the way we raise our children and found signs of this moral shift. For example, the early Girl Scout handbooks preached an ethic of self-sacrifice and self-effacement. The chief obstacle to happiness, the handbook exhorted, comes from the overeager desire to have people think about you. By 1980, as James Davison Hunter has pointed out, the tone was very different. You Make the Difference, the handbook for cadet and senior Girl Scouts, was telling girls to pay more attention to themselves. How can you get more in touch with you? What are you feeling? Every option available to you through senior scouting can, in some way, help you to a better understanding of yourself. Put yourself in the center stage of your thoughts to gain perspective on your own ways of feeling, thinking, and acting. The shift can even be seen in the words that flow from the pulpit. Joel Osteen, one of the most popular megachurch leaders today, writes from Houston, Texas, "God didn't create you to be average." Osteen says in his book, "Become a Better You." You were made to excel. You were made to leave a mark on this generation. Start believing, I've been chosen, set apart, destined to live in victory. The Humble Path. As years went by and work on this book continued, my thoughts returned to that episode of Command Performance. I was haunted by the quality of humility I heard in those voices. There was something aesthetically beautiful about the self-effacement the people on that program displayed. The self-effacing person is soothing and gracious, while the self-promoting person is fragile and jarring. Humility is freedom from the need to prove you are superior all the time. But egotism is a ravenous hunger in a small space. Self-concerned, competitive, and distinction-hungry. Humility is infused with lovely emotions like admiration, companionship, and gratitude. Thankfulness, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Michael Ramsay, said, is a soil in which pride does not easily grow. There is something intellectually impressive about that sort of humility, too. We have, the psychologist Daniel Kahneman writes, an almost unlimited ability to ignore our ignorance. Humility is the awareness that there's a lot you don't know, and that a lot of what you think you know is distorted or wrong. This is the way humility leads to wisdom. Montaigne once wrote, "We can be knowledgeable with other men's knowledge, but we can't be wise with other men's wisdom." That's because wisdom isn't a body of information. It's the moral quality of knowing what you don't know and figuring out a way to handle your ignorance, uncertainty, and limitation. The people we think are wise have, to some degree, overcome the biases and overconfident tendencies that are infused in our nature. In its most complete meaning, intellectual humility is accurate self-awareness from a distance. It is moving over the course of one's life from the adolescent's close-up view of yourself, in which you fill the whole canvas, to a landscape view in which you see, from a wider perspective, your strengths and weaknesses, your connections and dependencies, and the role you play in a larger story. Finally, there is something morally impressive about humility. Every epoch has its own preferred methods of self-cultivation, its own ways to build character and depth. The people on that command performance broadcast were guarding themselves against some of their least attractive tendencies, to be prideful, self-congratulatory, hubristic. Today, many of us see our life through the metaphor of a journey through the external world and up the ladder of success. When we think about making a difference or leading a life with purpose, we often think of achieving something external, performing some service that will have an impact on the world, creating a successful company, or doing something for the community. Truly humble people also use that journey metaphor to describe their own lives. But they also use, alongside that, a different metaphor, which has more to do with the internal life. This is the metaphor of self-confrontation. They are more likely to assume that we are all deeply divided selves, both splendidly endowed and deeply flawed, that we each have certain talents but also certain weaknesses. And if we habitually fall for those temptations and do not struggle against the weaknesses in ourselves, then we will gradually spoil some core piece of ourselves. We will not be as good internally as we want to be. We will fail in some profound way. For people of this sort, the external drama up the ladder of success is important, but the inner struggle against one's own weaknesses is the central drama of life. As the popular minister Harry Emerson Fosdick put it in his 1943 book On Being a Real Person, "The beginning of worthwhile living is thus the confrontation with ourselves." Truly humble people are engaged in a great effort to magnify what is best in themselves and defeat what is worst, to become strong in the weak places. They start with an acute awareness of the bugs in their own nature. Our basic problem is that we are self-centered, a plight beautifully captured in the famous commencement address David Foster Wallace gave at Kenyon College in 2005. Everything in my own immediate experience supports my deep belief that I am the absolute center of the universe, the realest, most vivid, and important person in existence. We rarely think about this sort of natural, basic self-centeredness because it's so socially repulsive. But it's pretty much the same for all of us. It is our default setting, hardwired into our boards at birth. Think about it. There is no experience you have had that you are not the absolute center of. The world as you experience it is there in front of you, or behind you, to the left or right of you, on your TV or your monitor, and so on. Other people's thoughts and feelings have to be communicated to you somehow, but your own are so immediate, urgent, real. This self-centeredness leads in several unfortunate directions. It leads to selfishness, the desire to use other people as means to get things for yourself. It also leads to pride, the desire to see yourself as superior to everybody else. It leads to a capacity to ignore and rationalize your own imperfections and inflate your virtues. As we go through life, most of us are constantly comparing and constantly finding ourselves slightly better than other people, more virtuous, with better judgment, with better taste. We're constantly seeking recognition and painfully sensitive to any snub or insult to the status we believe we have earned for ourselves. Some perversity in our nature leads us to put lower loves above higher ones. We all love and desire a multitude of things, friendship, family, popularity, country, money, and so on, and we all have a sense that some loves are higher or more important than other loves. I suspect we all rank those loves in pretty much the same way. We all know that the love you feel for your children or parents should be higher than the love you have for money. We all know the love you have for the truth should be higher than the love you have for popularity. Even in this age of relativism and pluralism, the moral hierarchy of the heart is one thing we generally share, at least most of the time. But we often put our loves out of order. If someone tells you something in confidence, and then you blab it as good gossip at a dinner party, you are putting your love of popularity above your love of friendship. If you talk more at a meeting than you listen, you may be putting your ardor to outshine above learning and companionship. We do this all the time. People who are humble about their own nature are moral realists. Moral realists are aware that we are all built from crooked timber. From Immanuel Kant's famous line, "Out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made." People in this crooked timber school of humanity have an acute awareness of their own flaws, and believe that character is built in the struggle against their own weaknesses. As Thomas Merton wrote, "Souls are like athletes that need opponents worthy of them, if they are to be tried and extended and pushed to the full use of their powers." You can see evidence of the inner struggle in such people's journals. They are exultant on days when they win some small victory over selfishness and hard-heartedness. They are despondent on days when they let themselves down, when they avoid some charitable task because they were lazy or tired, or failed to attend to a person who wanted to be heard. They are more likely to see their life as a moral adventure story. As the British writer Henry Fairley put it, "If we acknowledge that our inclination to sin is part of our natures, and that we will never wholly eradicate it, there is at least something for us to do in our lives that will not, in the end, seem just futile and absurd." I have a friend who spends a few moments in bed at night reviewing the mistakes of his day. His central sin, from which many of his other sins branch out, is a certain hardness of heart. He's a busy guy, with many people making demands on his time. Sometimes he is not fully present for people who are asking his advice or revealing some vulnerability. Sometimes he is more interested in making a good impression than in listening to other people in depth. Maybe he spent more time at a meeting thinking about how he might seem impressive than about what others were actually saying. Maybe he flattered people too unctuously. Each night he catalogues the errors. He tallies his recurring core sins and the other mistakes that might have branched off from them. Then he develops strategies for how he might do better tomorrow. Tomorrow he'll try to look differently at people, pause more before people. He'll put care above prestige, the higher thing above the lower thing. We all have a moral responsibility to be more moral every day, and he will struggle to inch ahead each day in this most important sphere. People who live this way believe that character is not innate or automatic. You have to build it with effort and artistry. You can't be the good person you want to be unless you wage this campaign. You won't even achieve enduring external success unless you build a solid moral core. If you don't have some inner integrity, eventually your Watergate, your scandal, your betrayal will happen. Adam 1 ultimately depends upon Adam 2. Now, I have used the word struggle and fight in the previous passages, but it's a mistake to think that the moral struggle against internal weakness is a struggle the way a war is a struggle, or the way a boxing match is a struggle, filled with clash of arms and violence and aggression. Moral realists sometimes do hard things, like standing firm against evil and imposing intense self-discipline on their desires. But character is built not only through austerity and hardship. It is also built sweetly, through love and pleasure. When you have deep friendships with good people, you copy and then absorb some of their best traits. When you love a person deeply, you want to serve them and earn their regard. When you experience great art, you widen your repertoire of emotions. Through devotion to some cause, you elevate your desires and organize your energies. Moreover, the struggle against the weaknesses in yourself is never a solitary struggle. No person can achieve self-mastery on his or her own. Individual will, reason, compassion, and character are not strong enough to consistently defeat selfishness, pride, greed, and self-deception. Everybody needs redemptive assistance from outside, from family, friends, ancestors, rules, traditions, institutions, exemplars, and, for believers, God. We all need people to tell us when we are wrong, to advise us on how to do right, and to encourage, support, arouse, cooperate, and inspire us along the way. There's something democratic about life viewed in this way. It doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or at a charity distributing medicine to the poor. It doesn't matter if you are at the top of the income scale or at the bottom. There are heroes and schmucks in all worlds. The most important thing is whether you are willing to engage in moral struggle against yourself. The most important thing is whether you are willing to engage this struggle well, joyfully and compassionately. Fairley writes, "At least if we recognize that we sin, know that we are individually at war, we may go to war, as warriors do, with something of valor and zest, and even mirth." Adam 1 achieves success by winning victories over others. But Adam 2 builds character by winning victories over the weaknesses in himself. The U-Curve. The people in this book led diverse lives. Each one of them exemplifies one of the activities that lead to character. But there is one pattern that recurs. They had to go down to go up. They had to descend into the valley of humility to climb to the heights of character. The road to character often involves moments of moral crisis, confrontation, and recovery. When they were in a crucible moment, they suddenly had a greater ability to see their own nature. The everyday self-deceptions and illusions of self-mastery were shattered. They had to humble themselves in self-awareness if they had any hope of rising up transformed. Alice had to be small to enter Wonderland. Or, as Kierkegaard put it, only the one who descends into the underworld rescues the beloved. But then the beauty began. In the Valley of Humility, they learned to quiet the self. Only by quieting the self could they see the world clearly. Only by quieting the self could they understand other people and accept what they are offering. When they had quieted themselves, they had opened up space for grace to flood in. They found themselves helped by people they did not expect would help them. They found themselves understood and cared for by others in ways they did not imagine beforehand. They found themselves loved in ways they did not deserve. They didn't have to flail about, because hands were holding them up. Before long, people who have entered the Valley of Humility feel themselves back in the uplands of joy and commitment. They've thrown themselves into work, made new friends, and cultivated new loves. They realize with a shock that they've traveled a long way since the first days of their crucible. They turn around and see how much ground they have left behind. Such people don't come out healed. They come out different. They find a vocation or calling. They commit themselves to some long obedience and dedicate themselves to some desperate lark that gives life purpose. Each phase of this experience has left a residue on such a person's soul. The experience has reshaped their inner core and given it great coherence, solidity, and weight. People with character may be loud or quiet, but they do tend to have a certain level of self-respect. Self-respect is not the same as self-confidence or self-esteem. Self-respect is not based on IQ or any of the mental or physical gifts that help get you into a competitive college. It is not comparative. It is not earned by being better than other people at something. It is earned by being better than you used to be, by being dependable in times of testing, straight in times of temptation. It emerges in one who is morally dependable. Self-respect is produced by inner triumphs, not external ones. It can only be earned by a person who has endured some internal temptation, who has confronted their own weaknesses, and who knows, well, if worse comes to worst, I can endure that. I can overcome that. The sort of process I've just described can happen in big ways. In every life, there are huge crucible moments, altering ordeals that either make you or break you. But this process can also happen in daily, gradual ways. Every day, it's possible to recognize small flaws, to reach out to others, to try to correct errors. Character is built both through drama and through the everyday. What was on display in Command Performance was more than just an aesthetic or a style. The more I looked into that period, the more I realized I was looking into a different moral country. I began to see a different view of human nature, a different attitude about what is important in life, a different formula for how to live a life of character and depth. I don't know how many people in those days hewed to this different moral ecology, but some people did, and I found that I admired them immensely. My general belief is that we've accidentally left this moral tradition behind. Over the last several decades, we've lost this language, this way of organizing life. We're not bad, but we are morally inarticulate. We're not more selfish or venal than people in other times. But we've lost the understanding of how character is built. The crooked timber moral tradition, based on the awareness of sin and the confrontation with sin, was an inheritance passed down from generation to generation. It gave people a clearer sense of how to cultivate the eulogy virtues, how to develop the Adam II side of their nature. Without it, there is a certain superficiality to modern culture, especially in the moral sphere. The central fallacy of modern life is the belief that accomplishments of the Adam I realm can produce deep satisfaction. That's false. Adam I's desires are infinite and always leap out ahead of whatever has just been achieved. Only Adam II can experience deep satisfaction. Adam I aims for happiness, but Adam II knows that happiness is insufficient. The ultimate joys are moral joys. In the pages ahead, I will try to offer some real-life examples of how this sort of life was lived. We can't and shouldn't want to return to the past. But we can rediscover this moral tradition, relearn this vocabulary of character, and incorporate it into our own lives. You can't build Adam II out of a recipe book. There is no 7-point program. But we can immerse ourselves in the lives of outstanding people and try to understand the wisdom of the way they lived. I'm hoping you'll be able to pick out a few lessons that are important to you in the pages ahead, even if they are not the same ones that seem important to me. I'm hoping you and I will both emerge from the next 9 chapters slightly different and slightly better. Chapter 2. The Summoned Self. Today, the area around Washington Square Park in Lower Manhattan is surrounded by New York University, expensive apartments, and upscale stores. But back in 1911, there were nice brownstones on the northern side of the park, and factories on its eastern and southern sides, drawing young and mostly Jewish and Italian immigrant workers. One of the nice homes was owned by Mrs. Gordon Norrie, a society matron descended from 2 of the men who signed the Declaration of Independence. On March 25th, Mrs. Norrie was just sitting down to tea with a group of friends when they heard a commotion outside. One of her guests, Frances Perkins, then 31, was from an old but middle-class Maine family, which could also trace its lineage back to the time of the Revolution. She had attended Mount Holyoke College and was working at the Consumers League of New York, lobbying to end child labor. Perkins spoke in the upper-crust tones befitting her upbringing, like Margaret Dumont in the old Marx Brothers movies or Mrs. Thurston Howell III, with long, flat A's, dropped R's, and rounded vowels. Tomato for tomato. A butler rushed in and announced that there was a fire near the square. The ladies ran out. Perkins lifted up her skirts and sprinted toward it. They had stumbled upon the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, one of the most famous fires in American history. Perkins could see the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors of the building ablaze and dozens of workers crowding around the open windows. She joined the throng of horrified onlookers on the sidewalk below. Some saw what they thought were bundles of fabric falling from the windows. They thought the factory owners were saving their best material. As the bundles continued to fall, the onlookers realized they were not bundles at all. They were people, hurling themselves to their death. "People had just begun to jump as we got there," Perkins would later remember. "They had been holding on until that time, standing in the window sills, being crowded by others behind them, the fire pressing closer and closer, the smoke closer and closer. They began to jump. The window was too crowded, and they would jump and they hit the sidewalk," she recalled. "Every one of them was killed. Everybody who jumped was killed. It was a horrifying spectacle." The firemen held out nets, but the weight of the bodies from that great height either yanked the nets from the firemen's hands, or the bodies ripped right through. One woman grandly emptied her purse over the onlookers below, and then hurled herself off. Perkins and the others screamed up to them, "Don't jump! Help is coming!" It wasn't. The flames were roasting them from behind. 47 people ended up jumping. One young woman gave a speech before diving, gesticulating passionately, but no one could hear her. One young man tenderly helped the young woman onto the windowsill, then he held her out away from the building, like a ballet dancer, and let her drop. He did the same for a second and a third. Finally, a fourth girl stood on the windowsill. She embraced him, and they shared a long kiss. Then he held her out and dropped her, too. Then he himself was in the air. As he fell, people noticed, as his pants ballooned out, that he wore smart tan shoes. One reporter wrote, "I saw his face before they covered it. You could see in it that he was a real man. He had done his best." The fire had started at about 4:40 that afternoon, when somebody on the 8th floor threw a cigarette or a match into one of the great scrap heaps of cotton left over from the tailoring process. The pile quickly burst into flames. Somebody alerted the factory manager, Samuel Bernstein, who grabbed some nearby buckets of water and dumped them on the fire. They did little good. The cotton scraps were explosively flammable, more so than paper, and there was roughly a ton of the stuff piled on the 8th floor alone. Bernstein dumped more buckets of water on the growing fire, but by this point they had no effect whatsoever, and the flames were spreading to the tissue paper patterns hanging above the wooden work desks. He ordered workers to drag a fire hose from a nearby stairwell. They opened the valve, but there was no pressure. As a historian of the fire, David von Drehle has argued, Bernstein made a fatal decision in those first 3 minutes. He could have spent the time fighting the fire or evacuating the nearly 500 workers. Instead, he battled the exploding fire to no effect. If he had spent the time evacuating, it is possible that nobody would have died that day. When Bernstein finally did take his eyes off the wall of fire, he was astonished by what he saw. Many of the women on the 8th floor were taking the time to go to the dressing room to retrieve their coats and belongings. Some were looking for their time cards so they could punch out. Eventually, the two factory owners up on the 10th floor were alerted to the fire, which had already consumed the 8th floor and was spreading quickly to their own. One of them, Isaac Harris, gathered a group of workers and figured it was probably suicidal to try to climb down through the fire. "Girls, let us go up on the roof. Get on the roof," he bellowed. The other owner, Max Blank, was paralyzed by fear. He stood frozen with a look of terror on his face, holding his youngest daughter in one arm and his elder daughter's hand with the other. A clerk who was evacuating with the firm's order book decided to throw it down and save his boss's life instead. Most of the workers on the 8th floor were able to get out, but the workers on the 9th floor had little warning until the fire was already upon them. They ran like terrified schools of fish from one potential exit to another. There were two elevators, but they were slow and overloaded. There was no sprinkler system. There was a fire escape, but it was rickety and blocked. On normal days, the workers were searched as they headed home to prevent theft. The factory had been designed to force them through a single choke point in order to get out. Some of the doors were locked. As the fire surrounded them, the workers were left to make desperate life-and-death decisions with limited information in a rising atmosphere of fire, smoke, and terror. Three friends, Ida Nelson, Katie Weiner, and Fanny Lansner, were in the changing room when the screams of fire reached them. Nelson decided to sprint for one of the stairwells. Weiner went to the elevators and saw an elevator car descending the shaft. She hurled herself into space, diving onto the roof. Lansner took neither course and didn't make it out. Mary Buccelli later described her own part in the vicious scramble to get out first. "I can't tell you because I gave so many pushes and kicks. I gave and received. I was throwing them down wherever I met them," she said of her co-workers. "I was only looking for my own life. At a moment like that, there is big confusion, and you must understand that you cannot see anything. You see a multitude of things, but you can't distinguish anything. With the confusion and the fight that you take, you can't distinguish anything." Joseph Brenman was one of the relatively few men in the factory. A crowd of women were pushing between him and the elevators, but they were small, and many of them were faint. He shoved them aside and barreled his way onto the elevator and to safety. The fire department arrived quickly, but its ladders could not reach the 8th floor. The water from its hoses could barely reach that high, just enough to give the building exterior a light dousing. Shame. The horror of the Triangle Shirtwaist fire traumatized the city. People were not only furious at the factory owners, but felt some deep responsibility themselves. In 1909, a young Russian immigrant named Rose Schneiderman had led the women who worked at Triangle and other factories on a strike to address the very issues that led to the fire disaster. The picketers were harassed by company guards. the city looked on indifferently, as it did upon the lives of the poor generally. After the fire, there was a collective outpouring of rage, fed by collective guilt at the way people had self-centeredly gone about their lives, callously indifferent to the condition